The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
It was a big week in the financial markets with several central bank policy decisions made. But at the center was the Federal Reserve. The Federal Open Market Committee left rates unchanged, but the release of the Fed's summary of economic projections and the commentary from Fed Chair Powell left the impression the Fed will stay tough on inflation for a while longer. Economic results and higher oil prices this week helped to push long-term rates to new highs, seeming to support the Fed's tough stance on inflation. Higher rates then led to lower stock prices late in the week. Focusing on the key event this week, Wednesday, the Federal Open Market Committee voted unanimously to leave the target range for the Fed funds rate unchanged at 5.25% to 5.5%. The summary of economic projections communicated two things: that policy rates are anticipated to remain higher for longer, and secondly, that Fed officials are not anticipating a cut to rates as much as they expected in the previous projections back in June. The median Fed funds rate estimate for 2023 stayed at 5.6%, but the median estimate for 2024 was 5.1%, up from 4.6% in June. 2025 showed a rate of 3.9% versus 3.4% in June, and the projections introduced an estimate for 2026 for the first time at 2.5%, suggesting the Fed will stay higher for longer, or higher for longest? We need a new saying now, I think. Stocks fell initially to the response, but rallied leading into Powell's post-release conference. After his opening response and during questioning, stocks led to a consecutive slide and on into Thursday's morning futures and daily trading. To paraphrase, Chair Powell started off by saying enough ground has been covered in previous rate hikes to proceed carefully, and that decisions will be based on the data and their risk assessment. He said a soft landing was always the primary objective, but the worst thing the Fed could do is fail to restore price stability. He finished by saying that if the economy comes in stronger than expected, that just means we will have to do more in terms of monetary policy to get back down to 2%. Because we will get back to 2%. In other central bank news, the Bank of England voted 5-4 to leave its bank rate unchanged at 5.25%. The Hong Kong Monetary Authority and Swiss National Bank also left their key interest rates unchanged at 5.75% and 1.75% respectively, whereas the Riksbank Bank and Norges Bank both raised their key interest rates by 25 basis points to 4% and 4.25% respectively. The economic data was mixed this week, depending on how you looked at it. The NAHB housing market index dropped to 45 in September from 50 in August. Housing starts in August hit their lowest level since June of 2020, but building permits were up 6.9%. Existing home sales continue to be sluggish due to higher mortgage rates and higher prices affecting affordability, while limited supply is being affected by disinterest in moving out of those sweet low-rate mortgages for existing homeowners. The median existing home price rose 3.9% year-over-year, and 72% of homes sold in August were on the market for less than a month. August leading indicators index still negative at negative 0.4%. Initial claims continued its weekly decline, down 20,000 claims to 201,000, which sent interest rates higher Thursday despite the first look at manufacturing in September, with the Philadelphia index down to a negative 13.5 from previously a positive 12 in August. The IPO market continues another strong week following the ARM offering last week, so there's still a healthy risk appetite out there for investors. Online grocery company Instacart, symbol CART, priced at $30 a share and opened for trading at $42 Tuesday, before closing at $33.70, giving back a big chunk of that morning gain. Marketing automation company Klaviyo, priced at $30 as well, traded as high as $37 intraday Wednesday before closing at $32.76. In more individual stock news, Cisco is to acquire Splunk, a data analytics company that's been gobbling other cybersecurity, cloud, and analytics companies since 2013 for $157 per share in cash, approximately a $28 billion equity value. FedEx beat on its earnings results and guided in line with estimates, which investors rewarded with a positive day, while Adobe underwhelmed investors with its fourth quarter guidance following better than expected earnings for the third quarter, driving weakness in tech earlier in the week. As of Thursday, Reuters was reporting that the UAW and the big three automakers were still far apart in their negotiations after the UAW rejected a Stellantis offer to increase pay by 21% over the contract term with a 10% immediate increase. However, in entertainment, CNBC was reporting that Hollywood writers and studios are close to reaching an agreement that could end the writers' strike, lifting some media companies. This wrap-up covers events leading up to midday Thursday due to our producer heading out on vacation, but if nothing else changes, it was a weak showing for stocks on a more hawkish Fed outlook, with rising oil and bond yields complementing the hawkish views. Housing data this week showed higher prices, low inventories, and low sales figures as a result, and the leading economic indicators are still negative. IPOs were strong, the UAW were still negotiating, and there was some hopeful news that writers in the entertainment industry may come to an agreement. Up next, an extended time here with Jim Bianco.
If you look at the past 10 years, the Western world as a whole has spent $4 trillion with a T, trillion, on wind and solar. And with that, our total energy use, electricity production has gone from 83% carbon-based to 81% carbon-based. So it's been a capital misallocation on an epic scale. If we'd used that $4 trillion and built nuclear instead, you know, the oil price would be low. Putin would have never invaded Ukraine. So, you know, there's been a failure of epic proportions.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, here we are. The Fed met. They left interest rates unchanged, but hinting another rate hike could be coming and maybe fewer rate cuts next year. Where are we going to go with this? Joining us on the program is Jim Bianco. Jim, let's begin with, they're already talking that a possibility of one more rate cut for next year. They're also talking about next year, they see rate cuts dropping to 5.1, which was much higher than the 4.6, and then 3.9 in 2025, and I think 2.9 in 2026. So what was your take of this Fed meeting and where they're going with this?
It has been more of the same in that they lay out a roadmap, a forecast, and then they have to revise that forecast higher, whether it's GDP, inflation, or interest rates. And by the way, real quick on that, I don't expect the Fed, private sector, or myself to be perfect with forecasting. The key to being a successful forecaster is recognize when you've made a mistake and change your forecast. And the Fed has not been very good at that. That was the whole transitory thing 2 years ago. But their forecast was moved higher. As you pointed out, 12 of the 19 Fed members said that they would raise rates at least one more time this year. That's November, December. In June, they said that they would be cutting interest rates by 100 basis points. An interest rate cut is 25, so that'd be four cuts. Now they said that they're going to do it two cuts. So they raised next year's year-end target up another 50 basis points as well. They raised their forecast for GDP. Now, part of 23 was a catch-up because the economy is growing much faster than the 1.1% that they thought it was going to grow in June. So they raised that up to near 2%. And they kept their inflation forecast fairly steady, and they lowered their unemployment forecast that the unemployment rate will not get above 4.1% in the next couple of years. Now, like I said, there's some things like that unemployment rate and some other things that I could scoff at and say, I don't believe it. But like I said, a forecast, all forecasts are wrong. It's just how long are you going to stick with your wrong forecast? And the reason we scoff at the Fed is they've got a pretty good history of kind of digging in with these bad forecasts until it's way too late. So if you sum all of that up, it sounds like to me an economy that looks like it's going to continue to advance without a recession. Inflation is going to come down. They're going to achieve the proverbial soft landing is what they're going to wind up getting here without there being a spike in the unemployment rate. Let me say one more thing about this. A lot of people are scoffing at that this is a fanciful forecast. It defies economic logic and stuff. And it sort of does and it doesn't. And the reason it doesn't is what they're forecasting is what happened between 2010 and 2020. And I've argued, and we could get into this later if you want, you know, that there was this event in the spring of 2020. And I'm talking about we shut down the global economy and we restarted the global economy. And that reboot of the global economy has lasting implications. The Fed doesn't think that. Powell used words normalization, rebalance, and a bunch of other words like that to say, look, we're going to get past, in fact, he even said, we're going to get past the effects of the pandemic. And to which, you know, they're of the opinion that that was a temporary thing. We shut it down, we restarted it, and everything's going to look like it was in 2019, including inflation and growth and interest rates. And my argument has been, no, it is not. That is the old cycle. We are in a new post-pandemic cycle of higher inflation, higher interest rates, and greater economic volatility. And if you want to keep forecasting that we're in the old cycle, then the question is, what's it going to take for you to understand that we're not? We're already 3 years past that, and they're still believing that 2020 was not a big event, was not a long-lasting event. It was a big event, but not a long-lasting event, where I think it was. It changed a lot of things about the economy that we're going to, quite frankly, deal with for the rest of our life. Now, last word for you on this. I've said this before on your podcast too. Change is not worse. Change is not dystopian. Change is different. And we need to understand that the cycle that we had is not the cycle that we have. And that's all I'm trying to say here. I'm not trying to say that we changed the economy, that we somehow made it worse. In some cases, some parts we did, but other parts we might have made it better.
I was watching another macro analyst talking about over the last 3 years, we've added $10 trillion of stimulus, both monetary and physical. And we've seen this on Wall Street where the recession forecast keeps being pushed out further. You know, first it was going to be second half this year. Now they're talking maybe first or second, and even, well, it may not even occur. And we've about ready to pass a new budget for next year. And I got a feeling there's going to be more spending in an election year. So in your opinion, is it possible that we may not see one, that maybe growth slows down to 1% or less?
Let me take that last part first. Are we going to pass a budget? That's news to me, because I thought that the Republicans were intent on shutting everything down on October 1st. And so hopefully they do pass a budget. But to the first part of your question, you're right that if you add up all of the debt that we've borrowed and all of the money that the Fed printed since 2020, that totals somewhere at around $10 trillion. If you look at the increase in GDP that we've had over that same period, it's about $2 trillion. That's nominal. And a good chunk of that has been inflation, just making everything more expensive. That's a higher GDP. Now, remember that debt, for people, what is debt? Debt is pulling forward future consumption. Why do young people borrow a 30-year mortgage to buy a house? Because we assume that when they're in their 50s and 60s, they will have saved enough money to afford that house. but they need it in their 30s when they're going to have children and raise a family. They can't wait until their 50s or 60s. So they borrow on their future consumption, a mortgage, in order to acquire those things that they want today. That's all debt does, is it pulls forward future consumption to now. Well, when you borrow too much debt, you've pulled all of the future consumption forward. And then further levels of debt, if I stick with the analogy I was using, you know, you have to go watch Star Trek episodes because you're pulling forward from the 22nd century at this point forward. And that has no impact today. You know, or to stick with my other analogy, those people in the 30s are not borrowing because in their 50s they can afford it. What they're saying is our children in their 50s could afford this house. So we're going to borrow on that assumption. And so that's why what you're seeing is more and more debt producing less and less GDP. When you don't have an overleveraged situation, borrowing is very effective. I would have bought it next year. I would have bought it in 5 years, but now I buy it now. And we get the production and the increase of GDP now. But eventually, when you've done all that, all debt has a very muted reaction to increasing the economy. And that's what we've been seeing now. And that's why people are getting worried, like me, about too much leverage in the economy, too much borrowing in the economy, that it actually becomes worse, not better, because we've already pulled everything forward.
This to me reminds me of a stagflationary environment where you've got anemic economic growth, but you've got inflation. And speaking of all this debt, I want to talk about the elephant in the room. We just added, I'm looking at the debt clock, we're over $33 trillion, $44 billion. We added $1 trillion of new debt in 92 days, and we'll probably be at $34 trillion by the end of the year, maybe $37-38 trillion next year. I'm looking at tax revenues. They've been coming down, which gets back to this thing that we're talking about, the economy. Because if the economy was more robust, you would expect to see higher tax revenues that would go along with that. So one of the things I'd like to get your take on, what do we do, Jim, when we have all this treasury debt that's rolling over? I'm looking at the 2-year note. It's the first time I've seen it over 5% in, gosh, well over a decade that we've been at that level. So what is going to happen with interest on the debt? Right now, it's about 23% of tax revenues. What is it going to be next year?
Right. Another way to express interest on the debt is it's about $900 billion in the Defense Department budget is estimated to be about $780 billion. So it's more than we spend on defense. And 4 years ago, that number was half that level. It was around $500 billion is what we were paying on interest. As far as what does it mean for the bond market, though, just to take that for starters, there's an old adage in the bond market that there are no bad bonds. There's only bad prices. That I'm not concerned that the debt won't get refinanced. It will get refinanced. It's just you may not like the price or the interest rate that it has to get refinanced at, and that we'll just have to do it at higher and higher levels of interest rates. Sovereign debt, treasury debt is at the top of the capital structure. Capital structure meaning what's the safest instrument, you know, treasury debt, then corporate debt, then high yield debt, then equities, then low rated equities, and on down the line. That will always get funded first. It always has the ability to say, it will find money from the stock market. How does it find money from the stock market? I will drive rates up so high, people will say, I don't want to own stocks anymore. I'll just buy this treasury debt. So that's what we've been seeing is these ever higher levels of interest rates to finance this debt. And it will probably continue to be that way. Now, there is an offset. There is an offset to that. And that offset is as our interest rates go up, and we're unique because we're the reserve currency, the dollar increases in value too, and it has been. The dollar has now had 9 consecutive weeks where it's gone up against the euro, to use one example, for the first time in at least 25 years that it's advanced 9 weeks against the euro. It's advancing against all the BRIC countries and everything else. So the rest of the world sees higher interest rates in the US and a stronger currency. I would like to be in the stronger currency because that gives me a gain. I buy the currency goes up. I would like those higher interest rates in the US too. So we're sucking in money from the rest of the world, which has always been funny because it's the same time you hear people talking about de-dollarization, the end of the reserve currency. It's pretty much the opposite right now, at least with the way that the markets are. The U.S. dollar has never been more attractive, but it's attractive only in that it is got this higher interest rate. So that will help at the margin. That means that interest rates won't go to the moon, but they will definitely stay higher and continue to creep higher as we go forward.
I want to talk about something the BRIC countries are doing. We've seen tremendous buying of gold by central banks. You know, individual investors have been selling gold and silver. I think it's like 600 tons. Central banks have bought like 1,200 tons or more. And there's talk about using gold or using that in some kind of settlement for oil. We've got, you know, China dealing in yuan for oil. What is this going to do to the gold market? Because right now I'm looking at spreads over in Shanghai. It's about $50 higher for gold, and it's about $2 higher for silver. If I'm Harry Hedge Fund, why not buy gold off London and New York, sell it in Shanghai for $50 more?
I think that in one, they are, and two, that is a highly regulated market in Shanghai. So it's not as easy as just buy it here and ship it there. And, you know, there's a lot of regulations and hoops and barriers and restrictions to doing it, but there they are trying it. But now that getting back to your question about gold and about the BRICS countries, last month, the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa got together in a big meeting, and they said that they want to start using their currencies for international settlements on trade. The Saudis would like to get paid in Saudi dinar, and you know, the Chinese want to get paid in yuan. But right now, almost all international trade, the vast majority of it, is you settle it in U.S. dollars. Now, why, even if it is between China and Saudi Arabia, it is settled in dollars. Why is it settled in dollars? Because it's the biggest, deepest, most liquid capital market in the world. And when you're trading 30 million, 35 million barrels a day, that's what OPEC trades. The world does about 90 million. You know, throw in another 15 million for Russia, your currency, your capital markets cannot handle that big a trade flow. Only the U.S. dollar can. The idea that we could back it by gold, oh, sure, you could argue that, but in reality, it's not going to be that simple. This is somewhat analogous to the argument you hear from the cryptocurrency crowd. Oh, we could use Bitcoin. No, you can't. It's got to be like 1,000 times larger in order to use. Well, that means the price is going to go to 10 million. No, I mean, the settlement layer of being able to settle 60, 80, 100,000 transactions a second without ever making a mistake needs to happen. That is not there. The only option there is the U.S. dollar. Now, the BRICS countries can get together and they could decide we don't like the U.S. dollar, and I know they don't, and they would like another reserve currency, and sure, I know they would. So therefore, we're going to put together a scheme that's going to lose us tons of money by trading in our own currency, which is what they did. They will do a handful of ceremonial transactions in those currencies, and then they'll go back to the dollar because they've got no choice. Now, this is not to say that somewhere down the line, there won't be an alternative to the dollar. I still think there might very well be. And I would argue to you, it might very well be a cryptocurrency, but it still might be 15 years away at this point. That market has to develop a little bit more. It could be the gold market, but the gold market cannot, you cannot trade gold to the level that you need. So like it or not, you know, to paraphrase Winston Churchill, the dollar is one of the worst reserve currencies ever created, except for all of the other options. So we're kind of stuck with it, whether you like it or not. So what I'm trying to say is, whenever I hear people talking about the dollar's going to stop being the reserve currency, and they tell me all the problems that the dollar has, I always used to stop them and say, you're right. It has every problem you said and seven that you didn't bring up. What's the better alternative? The yuan, which isn't even a convertible currency. The euro, it's been around for 23 years and no one has adopted that. The yen is not going to do it. Crypto is too small. Gold has been around for 5,000 years and it has no settlement feature. How do I trade micro ounces of gold on real-time settlement? It's not possible. Only the U.S. dollar is. So we're stuck with it, even though we've got all of these problems.
Well, it's the old saying, it's the cleanest shirt in a dirty laundry basket. So,
yeah, exactly.
I want to talk about the role of gold itself. You would expect in an inflationary environment, geopolitical environment, gold would have done a lot better than it did. I mean, it was driven by China in the 00 decade. As China came in, there was a greater demand for it coming from India. But it did well for, what, to March of this year? It's hanging in there because there's strong central bank buying. But what's your take on gold, and why do you think it hasn't gone higher given the circumstances we're dealing with today?
I agree with you. If you were to line up all of the stories in theory, what would be very good for gold? How about a war in Europe? How about inflation? How about economic uncertainty? How about political uncertainty as well? How about throwing all of that into the mix? You would have said this is a great time for gold. But the spot price of gold is up 6% this year, and the spot price of silver is down 2%. So it really hasn't done anything. And I've said this on your podcast before, it's been the single most frustrating asset class I've seen, because everything seems to have been lined up for gold to not just go higher in the future. It should have gone higher 2 years ago is what it should have done, but it really hasn't. The only thing that I could come up with is there is a lack of investment demand for gold. First, people didn't want it. And now the problem that it has to compete with is not only crypto, but that's probably a small version of it. It has to compete with coupons and real assets. That, you know, if you go back 4 years ago, you could have said, why would you buy gold? It doesn't yield anything. And you'd say, well, neither do treasuries. But now today, your question is, why don't you buy gold? It doesn't yield anything. When a treasury bill yields 5.5%. And I think that is become the main competition for gold, is that these higher sovereign yields around the world, these safe liquid instruments like a treasury bill, you know, written into banking law and written into a lot of investment contracts, when you have to put up cash, like a margin at a futures exchange, a treasury bill is considered cash. It is considered as safe as cash, and it yields 5.5%. So why would I buy something that doesn't have any yield and probably has a storage cost if you're talking about physical gold, or at least that storage cost is reflected in the role in the futures if you were to buy futures on it? So I think that that's where gold is really suffering, is for the moment, it is people are looking at sovereign debt, especially things like treasury bills, and saying, for the first time in 15 years, these things have yield. I'd rather own that than I'd rather own gold.
I want to turn to another commodity, which is oil. The Biden administration canceled 7 leases for drilling in Alaska. They're holding up permits in the Gulf of Mexico, and yet we're sending Chevron into Venezuela. So if you look at where oil is right now, you know, it's 90. I think we could hit possibly 100 this year, just looking at some of the stats. What's your take on energy? Because we're trying to make this green transition. I'm writing an article right now on the green transition. I looked at EVs, I looked at windmills, and I looked at solar panels. And I looked at the amount of minerals that go into them. One that really struck me was aluminum. Well, to do green, you have to do mining. To do mining, you need diesel fuel. You need trucks. You need fossil fuels to do this. It's like nobody's thinking this through. How are we going to do all this stuff? And I live in California where we have brownouts all the time, and we have some of the highest utility and gas rates in the country.
Yeah, you know, as far as the green revolution goes, you're right that we've got this big push into going into green. There's a great podcast out there by an economist named Mark Mills. I think it's called The Last Man Standing. And he did a whole 4-part series about EVs. And he pointed out it takes 500,000 pounds of excavation. And as you pointed out, there's a lot of diesel. There's a lot of carbon intensity with that to produce a 1,000-pound EV battery. That does not get figured into the carbon footprint of an EV car. Now, when you start figuring that in, and no one's done a study on it, the EV or the carbon footprint of an EV car starts to approach the carbon footprint of a gasoline-powered car. It's still more efficient, but not that much more efficient when you start considering all of these other things. So, yeah, as we push back and say, we want to push green, we want to push green, we seem to be going too fast. The day we're recording, there was a story that the UK and Europe has now, they wanted to mandate the end of gasoline, internal combustion engine cars by 2030. They just pushed that out to 2035 because they just realized that it's not realistic that we can make the transition that fast. So carbon, energy, fossil fuels, crude oil is going to be with us for a long time. And all of these restrictions, these environmental restrictions and the like are just going to push the price up. Now, let me turn to the other side of the equation, demand. Bloomberg does a good study where they look at the demand. They look at, they do a thing called imputed demand. And what that means is they look at how much was produced, how much was imported, what was the change in inventories in the United States for crude oil for the week, that whatever that adds up to is that's what we consumed. That was the imputed demand. Imputed demand has spiked this summer to an all-time high of over 20 million barrels a day. So we are demanding crude oil at record amounts at the same time. Why are we demanding crude oil? It's a measure of economic growth. When you have economic growth, people want to make things, go places, do things that requires energy. We demand more crude oil. When the economy slows, we do less of all of that, and the demand for crude oil goes down. But the demand for crude oil in the United States and in Europe is at records. It's down in China because their economy is weak, but we've more than offset that. So if you want to have, if you want to put green restrictions on the production of crude oil, the Saudis and the Russians, which is part of what's called OPEC Plus, are pulling back on production as well to push the price higher. And you've got record demand. This is why in 2.5 months, the price of crude oil is up 37%. And it's showing, I think, no signs of slowing down right now because that market is not in supply-demand balance yet, and it can continue to churn higher. So yeah, I think that energy could go up. Now, if you want a cynical answer, 2 weeks ago, Aramco announced that they're going to do, Aramco is the Saudi national oil company, used to stand for Arab American Oil Company, but now it's completely owned by the Saudis. They're going to do a secondary stock offering. It's one of the largest companies in the world. It's like a $2 trillion market cap, about the same size as Apple. And they want to raise $50 billion in a secondary. Okay, the Saudis also have a 2030 plan to get the country off of fossil fuels by 2030, which is, again, going to probably become a 2040 plan because they can't go that fast. Why would an investor want to buy a secondary in Aramco when the government that runs Aramco is saying they want to get out of the fossil fuel business? Ah, they're going to ramp the price up so high, they're going to make you want to own this thing, is what they're going to do. And the cynical answer is because they're buying football players from Europe and trying to start a new soccer league to compete with Europe, and they're paying them huge sums of money. And actually, that's a cynical answer on my part, but that's actually been mentioned as one of the reasons that they need this extra money is that they're trying to get money to take their economy off of fossil fuels and try and make their economy more appealing to the rest of the world by getting into businesses like golf and soccer and potentially tennis and everything else. So the cynical answer I would give you is if the Saudis want to get investors to give them $50 billion for Aramco, they're going to have to get the price of oil up a lot to make investors look past all of these problems I just laid out and say, I just got to own Aramco. So all of that sums up that I think the price of energy is going to continue, has been up 37% in 2.5 months, and will continue to move higher from here.
Well, I'm of the opinion, Jim, that we're going to see inflation for a lot longer and a lot higher than what the Fed is saying right now. I want to turn to EVs for a minute because we've got the strikes going on with United Auto Workers. They're concerned about EVs because it may in the future mean less workers. And the other thing is I've talked to dealers. They're sitting on the lots. People don't necessarily like them. They don't work very well in cold weather. They work well in California, where we have a lot of sunshine. So even if we're talking about EVs, it's a problem for the automakers. They're losing money. And now we've got this strike going on.
Yeah, let me say a nice thing about EVs, and a sincerely nice thing about EVs. They are great cars, provided, of course, you already have a three-car garage, and you got an $80,000 SUV on one side, you got a $60,000 sedan on the other side, just slotted an EV in the middle in your three-car garage, it is a fantastic car to own. If you live in the city of Chicago like I do, and you have to park on the street, and it's going to be 5 below, and it's going to snow 8 inches tonight, and you're 200 feet from the nearest charging port, meaning that 200-foot electrical cord into your apartment, and you were only a half-charge battery, good luck starting that thing tomorrow morning. So it has an appeal, but it is not necessarily ready for the broad-based appeal. Look, let's be fair about the internal combustion engine car. It took them 50 years, them being Detroit, 50 years to really get the internal combustion engine car to the point where we all drive these things. We don't know how they work. We stick the key in them. Now we don't even need to stick a key in them. We push a button. They just start. They go. We change the oil once a year. We fill it with gas, and we don't ever think about anything else. The EVs can eventually become that ubiquitous. They're just not there right now. But to your point about the strikes, there's a common theme about a lot of these strikes that are coming down the pike. The Hollywood strike is about AI and about new technology putting them out of work. A big reason that you're seeing the UAW strike is about a new technology with EVs and putting them out of work. There's healthcare strikes that are being rumored that might be coming by October from a lot of healthcare workers for the same reason. New technology, AI, might reduce their workforces. So really, when you look at all of these strikes, even the UPS strike, the West Coast port strike, the potential strike that we had with train workers last year, it's easy for us to just say, greedy, they just want more money, blah. But it really what's driving a lot of these strikes is this transformational change that is occurring to the economy, and that people that are uncomfortable with the transformational change. In other words, we don't want change. We want it to be the way it was, are trying to band together and push back against it. I think this is all part of what I said at the beginning, that we're in a post-COVID world right now. It's a very different world than it used to be. And part of the thing that's also happening in a post-COVID world was, I think that labor is also getting an upper hand over management in dictating a lot of these things. Did we not have technological change in 2015 to 2020? Yes, we did. But in 2015 to 2020, labor never felt like they had any bargaining power to do anything about it. But in 2023, they think they do. And it's more than just Joe Biden says he's the most union-friendly president ever. I think it's more than that. It's that they actually genuinely have an upper hand because of the changes in the economy since COVID. Remote work, I've talked about this with you in the past, is just a high-profile example of that. And when you look at what's going on with the economy, there's a lot more than just being able to say, oh, they're just greedy, they want more money. They're actually afraid about technological change, and they're trying to push back against it.
Well, this gets back to your change coming out of COVID, and I just wonder if the authorities, whether it's Treasury, whether it's the Fed, and the institutions have come to grips with this change. It seems like the change is leading everything else, and we're trying to play catch-up and understand it.
The simple answer is no, they do not understand it, and they do not believe it. Because, as I said before, if you listen to Powell in his press conference, if you listen to Yellen, the economy is normalizing. We're rebalancing. What do these words mean? That the way it used to be in 2019, we're going back to that. We're going, like I said, what is the underlying theme of the Fed's forecast of we're not going to have a rise in unemployment. We're going to not have a recession, but the inflation rate's going to go back to 2%. This is the same economy that we had in 2018. That's, if you believe that, then you've got a modicum of credibility that, yeah, then that forecast might actually work. But if you think that when we had the shutdown restart of the economy, what came out of that was a different attitude among people. Remote work is the attitude. Jim, I know we've talked about this in previous calls, like, you know, I know people, you know people that, you know, they say my boss wants me back at the office 5 days a week, and so therefore I quit. And in 2019, I would have said to that person, you got to go see a psychiatrist. What's wrong with you? You're going to quit because your boss wants you in the office every day. But in 2023, we kind of just nod our head and go, well, that's kind of the way the world works now. That's a huge change. That is a huge change that has really changed the economy. Like I said, it's now worse. A lot of people might argue it's better because now I get more time at home. It's different. And Janet Yellen, Jay Powell, Gina Raimondo, their commerce secretary, Joe Biden, on down the line, they don't think any of this stuff is changed. They still think it is the 2019 economy, which is why they use words like normalization and rebalancing, which is code word for, in fact, Jay Powell said in his press conference, the effects of the pandemic shutdown are going away. No, they're not. What the pandemic did was it took trends, the remote work trend. The remote work trend was in place for decades, but it was moving from 0.5% to 0.6% to 8% to 1%. And then we had the shutdown, restarted the economy, and went from 1% to 33%. So we just, you know, to use my Star Trek analogy before, we were going to get here in 50 years. We just got here in 3 is what happened. Now we need to understand that the trend that was in place just got sped up. We didn't create something new. We got here faster and we need to adjust to it. But instead of adjusting to it, we walk around going rebalance, normalization, the effects are dissipating. There's going to be no change. And that's why it's been such a difficult economy for a lot of people. They are expecting a return to the old economy and they're not coming to grips with the economy that we have right now.
And I want to give you an example as it relates to real estate. I've been talking to realtors. Jim, we have a house that's just close to our neighborhood. It was 2,900 square feet. It was priced at $2 million, which still amazes me. It was on the market in 5 days. It was gone. And then I read in the paper, there was some big mansion in Rancho Santa Fe sold for $25 million. And I was talking to my realtor. I go, where's this money coming from with the kind of mortgages? They said, a lot of Silicon Valley, this gets back to your remote working. A lot of guys, Google, Apple, they can work down here where the price of real estate is a lot cheaper, fly once a month into Apple's headquarters or Google, but it's cheaper here than it is there. And this gets back to your work remote theory that's we're seeing.
Yes. In fact, Bloomberg had a story exactly on this yesterday that they said, if you look at where all the remote workers live, they said that they lived within 30 miles of their office. In other words, the home that they lived in that they commuted to every day. But more and more, those workers are starting to recognize remote work isn't going away. And this is, you know, so why would, to use my example, why would I live in suburban Chicago? Why don't I move to Phoenix or to Florida? And I'll just fly up here once a month or twice a month for the meetings. And I could just remote work where I am in other places. And by the way, I do want to say one thing about remote work. If anybody's listening to me and scowling that everybody's in their pajamas and not working and stuff, it isn't that bad, because remember that most people that remote work, you have a service sector job. You have to, your job is basically two things, things you have to do or proficiency, update reports, you know, do answer emails, do those kind of things as well. And then there's people you have to interact with, either your coworkers, your customers, or your vendors. What we're finding with remote work is when you have things to do in a service sector job, I got to answer some emails, I got to update reports and stuff like that. It's best done at home. Don't bother me. Let me just finish this. And I get it done. I'm much more efficient, much more productive at home. It's when I have to interact with my coworkers, my customers, my vendors. Zoom is not the best place to do that. It's better than not doing Zoom, but it's definitely not the best place to do that. So remote work isn't necessarily a big loser in that it's going to kill the economy or anything. We just need to adjust to it. We need to learn to it and understand it. And as we do, you're right. People are going to look at Rancho Santa Fe. They're going to look at Paradise in Phoenix. They're gonna look at Broward County and they're gonna go, why do I live in Naperville, Illinois again? Oh yeah, because I used to commute to the office every day. Believe me, Naperville's a very nice place, but I live there because it was an easy commute to the office. Well, now that I don't have to be in the office, you know, why don't I move to Florida? You know, by the way, the taxes are lower in Florida than they are in Illinois too. And so you're starting to see that happen across the board.
So as we kind of draw this to a conclusion, we've got Fed change. Interest rates look like they're going to remain higher for longer, possible another rate cut, fewer rate cuts next year. And we have for, you know, and I would say this is even inflationary in some sense, Jim, because think of all the retirees, the boomers heading into retirement. They got zero on their cash. Now they're getting 5% in the money market. That's spending power. That's putting bucks in your wallet. So how do you make money in this kind of environment?
Right. So let me start with the second part, the last part first. When we talk about higher interest rates, what we're learning is that this really hurts government finances, higher interest rates, because the government doesn't own any assets. They only issue bonds. They get like the Fed buys a bunch of treasuries, and then the Fed at the end of the year, this is true if you weren't aware of it, they own like $6 trillion of treasuries. And then at the end of the year, the Fed takes all of the coupon payments that they got from the treasury, less their expenses, and then returns them back to the treasury. Well, they're just giving you back your own money is all they're doing at that point. So higher interest rates hurts government finances, what I'm trying to say. But the household, there's according to the personal income data, there's about $1.8 trillion of interest earning assets that the households in the United States own. So all of us have either in a bank account, a money market account, or own bonds outright, about $1.8 trillion of assets that are earning us interest rates and now a positive interest rate. We have about $500 to $600 billion of debt that we're paying off. And most of that is mortgage debt. So on balance, we get more interest income, we being households, the entire household sector gets more interest income than they pay out in interest expense. So when interest rates go up, it actually somewhat helps households. Now there's various sectors of the households that are different. Older people that tend to not have mortgages anymore, they benefit and tend to invest more conservatively, win more with higher interest rates because they were always investing in bonds and other safer assets and they're getting more. Younger people that are looking to buy a home that don't have many assets, starting a family, they tend to lose because they're just taking out a mortgage and they got to buy a home and they don't have a big bank account full of bonds that are churning out in interest rates or money in a money market fund for that fact that's churning out interest rates. They probably do, but not to the extent of the mortgage and everything else they have. So on balance, I think what's happened to the household sector with higher interest rates is not as negative as it has been for the government sector. So that's the first point I want to bring. To your other point, we talked about, yes, the Fed is on track to say that they're going to raise rates one more time. They say they're going to cut rates twice next year. They said in June they'd cut rates four times next year. As I said earlier, the trend has been that they underestimate the amount of interest rate increases they're going to do. I think that's still the case. I think they're going to raise rates one more time this year, and that they would not be surprised if they raise rates again in 24, at least one more time, or at a very minimum, there's going to be no rate cut in 24. I think inflation, given all the talk about the economy is different, that means frictions, that means imbalances, that means higher costs, that means stickier inflation. Inflation's going to stay stickier. Interest rates are going to stay higher. And so I think the interest rates we're seeing, the day we're talking, the 10-year note hit 441, which is a new 16-year high, and the 2-year note hit 5.19%, which is a new 17-year high. I think that those rates will continue to move up. They will provide competition for riskier assets like stocks. And what we've seen with the stock market is since the middle of June, the S&P's gone nowhere. It's just been meandering sideways. If you break it down, of course, they're the big concentration in the market. The stocks that are associated with AI, the Magnificent Seven, have been doing better. The stocks that when you get away from the Magnificent Seven and you go to traditional companies, consumer product, industrial, basic materials, those stocks have not been doing as good. They're not tanking like last year, They've just been kind of sideways to slightly down. I think it's higher interest rates that's really dragging on them. And I think it's not just higher interest rates in terms of the cost of the company. It's the competition that investors have. Why would I want to buy these companies when I can go get a 5.5% money market fund with no risk at all? I will get 5.5%. I don't have to worry about the price of treasury bills plunging and losing money like I have to do with a stock. And I think that that's going to continue to be the story as we go into 2024. You know, the theme stocks like AI will play and maybe not play. Maybe a new theme will come into play as well too. But the general level of the stock market or of equities is going to have to deal with higher interest rates because of inflation. And the story here is part of what's going on is strong economy, as I talked about with crude oil demand. Maybe the household is not being impaired as much by higher interest rates because they've got interest income to offset those interest expenses. So the economy, to use the phrase, has no landing. No landing. People ask me all the time, what's no landing? Well, we talk about a hard landing, and that's a recession. We talk about a soft landing, and that's a slowdown. No landing is just continuing what the metaphor means, that the economy just does not land. It just continues to churn out positive quarters. By the way, history shows that the no landing argument is what happens 85% of the time. 85% of the years in the last 100 years have not been recessionary years. That's a no landing year. So the economy doesn't slow down. It continues to churn out 2, 3, maybe 4% growth from quarter to quarter. We continue to have 3-ish or so inflation. And the bond market looks around and goes, that means that the 10-year yield might have to go above 5% and stay there. That the 2-year yield might have to go near 6% and stay there. And if that happens, then investors are going to look at those yields and go, why do I only want these basic material stocks? Why do I want these industrial stocks or these consumer product company stocks when I can get that in the bond market? Oh, the AI stocks? Maybe I believe that there's some transformational company there and I might take a flyer on one or two of those, but that's not the entire stock market. So into 2024, I think the story is going to continue to be interest rates. And I think that I believe the story is going to be higher interest rates because of stickier inflation and no recession as we move forward.
So higher for longer and possibly a stock market just that goes nowhere, sideways.
Right. I'm not necessarily saying that the stock market is going to crash or have a terrible year. It had it last year, the terrible year. But I'm saying that that pull that interest rates had, if you take out those magnificent seven companies, those AI companies, what happened to the stock market in the last 2 years? Big down last year and kind of sideways this year, because if you look at the 493 companies in the S&P that are not the magnificent seven AI companies, those companies are only up in aggregate 5% this year. The Russell 2000, which are small cap companies, is up about 4% this year. And there's an index called the microcap, which is the bottom 1,000 of the Russell 2000 companies. That's still down on the year. It's down like 2% on the year. So that's really what we're looking at is more of that. Now, investors can be forgiven. Well, the S&P's up 16% this year. Yes, because 12 of it is seven stocks. And four of it is 493 stocks. And if those seven stocks stop working, then you're back to what are the other 493 going to do for you? And the answer is, in a world of higher interest rates, not a whole lot. Because that's what they have not been giving you, not a whole lot, as we've been seeing this year.
Couldn't agree more. Well, listen, Jim, as we close, tell our listeners how they can follow you. You do some of the best macro analysis I know.
Well, thank you very much. Well, of course, there's our website, biancoresearch.com. Take a look there. You can request a free trial. There's Twitter, X, whatever we're calling it this week, at Bianco Research. My standard warning is look for me with the blue check mark and the 350,000 followers. And I say that only because I got a lot of spam accounts that impersonate me. Elon's got to fix that. I can't fix it. Don't follow the wrong account. Or you can follow me at Jim Bianco on LinkedIn.
All right. Great stuff as always, Jim. Have a great rest of the year.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.